I guess all the copies of the paper I made were given out. There are about twice as many people here as I expected tonight. If others would like one, I could have one made up later for you if you give me your name and address. Now the subject, as you have it in the paper before you, Charles Darwin has been called the Newton of biology. T.H. Huxley said that the publication of The Origin of Species marks the hegira of science from the idolatries of special creation to the purer faith of evolution. Many have spoken as though the idea of evolution started in 1859, when Darwin's book appeared. But this idea is quite erroneous. In 1959, 100 years after the publication of Darwin's book, Professor Lauren C. Isley of the University of Pennsylvania published a book entitled Darwin's Century. After saying that he would not in this book discuss the ancient Greek ideas of evolution, but simply look at the precursors of Darwin within the preceding two centuries, Isley describes in detail evolutionary views held by a number of previous writers. He declares that many of these views were very similar to the views later advanced by Darwin, and he says that at least one previous writer presented views almost identical with what Darwin later taught. It would come as a shock to those who imagine that evolution began with Darwin if they were to look into Disraeli's novel. Disraeli, you know, was the great Prime Minister of England for many years under Queen Victoria. Disraeli's novel Tancred, published 12 years before Darwin's Origin of Species appeared. In this book, a fashionable lady speaks as follows. You know, all is development. The principle is perpetually going on. First there was nothing, then there was something, then, I forget the next, I think there were shells, then fishes. Then we came, let me see, did we come next? Never mind that, we came at last. And at the next change there will be something very superior to us, something with wings. Oh, that's it, we were fishes, and I believe we shall be crows. But you must read it. When her companion replied, I don't believe I ever was a fish, the lady continues, oh, but it's all proved, you understand, it's all science. It's not like these books in which one said one thing and another the contrary, and both may be wrong. Everything is proved by geology, you know. In having his character speak in this fashion, Disraeli was reflecting the great contemporary interest in a book called Vestiges of Creation that had appeared in 1844, 15 years before the publication of Darwin's book. This book presented a thoroughgoing idea of evolution. Charles Darwin read this book with great care and made extensive notes in the margin of his copy. Another scientist named Thomas Henry Huxley, of whom more later, wrote a savage review in which he strongly attacked many of its statements, using such phrases as mean view of nature, pretentious nonsense, and foolish fancies. The book did not have much standing among reputable scientists, but in the world of fashion and intellectual dilettanteism, it was very influential. The idea of evolution was not new. Darwin's part was not to originate it, but to give it respectability. Charles Darwin was a careful observer of nature, who had spent nearly 4 years on a voyage to South America and other areas, examining plants, animals, and geologic formations. Returning to England, he devoted himself to careful scientific research and carried on correspondence with others with similar interests. At one time, he devoted 8 years to studying thousands of barnacles. When one of Bulwer-Lytton's novels described a Professor Long, who was said to have written two large volumes about limpets, many people immediately recognized Darwin as the original of the character. There were many who were already familiar with the idea of organic evolution, that the great profusion of plants and animals had come to exist, not because of the purpose of a wise and powerful creator, but because of the operation of purely natural forces working in a haphazard way. In order to understand the situation in the middle of the 19th century, we must look at what preceded. In the latter part of the previous century, John Wesley and George Whitefield and their associates had led in the Great Awakening, which changed the whole moral and religious tone of the English-speaking world. The generation of fiery evangelists and devoted spiritual leaders was succeeded by a generation in which there was great emphasis on social service and human improvement. The effects of the Great Awakening continued even into the third generation. But by this time, there were many who longed to be free from the shackles of Christian morality and outlook. The forms of orthodoxy were rigorously maintained, but rationalism was rapidly spreading among the educated classes. Few of men were ready to follow Herbert Spencer in attacking Christianity directly and forcibly, but many desired to escape from biblical ideas. It is necessary to have this situation in mind to understand the explosive effect of Darwin's book. In the years 1832 to 1836, when Darwin had stopped at various places on the coast of South America, he had been surprised to see the great number of kinds of similar plants and animals and their progression. He pondered over the great variety and profusion of plant life and wondered how such variety had come into existence. One day in October 1838, while recovering from an illness, he amused himself by reading a book by Thomas Robert Malthus called An Essay on Population. This book had been much discussed since the appearance of its first edition in 1797. Malthus advanced the idea that mankind keeps increasing geometrically while its food supply increases over arithmetically, and that therefore wars, pestilence, and famine are unavoidable unless some other means of checking the increase of population should be found. As Darwin read this book, he thought of the great number of animals and plants that are produced and how comparatively few of them manage to survive and in turn to produce offspring. Then it occurred to him that this might be the key to the origin of the many types of plants and animals that exist. Since no offspring is exactly like its parent, he assumed that in time a great variety of offspring would proceed from any one sort. Out of this great variety, only those with characteristics that could enable them to meet the conditions of their environment or to overcome the attacks of their natural enemies would be able to survive and produce further offspring. Thus, gradual changes would occur. Darwin thought of these possible changes as being quite unlimited and therefore able to produce extremely great results over a period of time. Although he called his idea natural selection, he later said that perhaps it might better have been described by the term survival of the fittest, which Herbert Spencer had originated. As soon as the idea of natural selection occurred to Darwin, he decided to gather facts that would support it. He wrote out a statement of his theory and placed it in a safe, returning to it from time to time to add further evidence and intending eventually to publish a large work in which he would deal fully with the matter. In 1858, a young naturalist named Alfred Russel Wallace was engaged in scientific study in the East Indies. As he pondered over the varieties of plants and animals that he saw there, he was laid up by illness for a few days and amused himself by reading Malthus' Essay on Population. As he did so, he hit upon exactly the same theory that had entered Darwin's mind from the same source. He immediately wrote an article presenting his idea rather fully and sent it to Darwin. Darwin was greatly surprised to find that Wallace had proposed exactly the same theory that he himself had thought of 20 years earlier. He feared that Wallace might publish it first and thus be considered its originator. Yet he did not wish to do anything that would be unfair to Wallace. When he discussed the matter with his friends and showed them the great similarity between Wallace's article and his own previous statement, they suggested that he allow them to read both statements at a meeting of a scientific society. Darwin accepted the suggestion. At the meeting of the Linnean Society on July 1, 1858, separate statements of the views of both Darwin and Wallace were read, along with a prefatory letter explaining the circumstances. The 30 scientists present seemed to have felt no particular interest in the presentation. A few months later, when the president of the Linnean Society reviewed the events of the year 1858, he declared that he could find no memorable scientific progress to record. Darwin soon began to fear that either Wallace or someone else might publish the theory ahead of him. His friends urged him immediately to put it in print himself. He therefore spent several months writing a book which he called on the origin of species by means of natural selection or the preservation of favored races in the struggle for life. One of Darwin's friends asked a London firm to issue Darwin's book. When the publisher looked it over, he thought it would not sell. Yet he was well impressed with its observations about pigeons. And he urged Darwin instead to write a book on that subject, saying everybody's interested in pigeons. However, Darwin insisted that the book be published exactly as it was, and the publisher hesitantly agreed to do so. Much to the surprise of both Darwin and the publisher, the book was immediately received with great acclaim. The reason for this is easy to see. As we've noticed, many who desired to abandon the biblical teaching about creation had become fascinated by the idea of evolution. This idea had been strongly criticized by outstanding scientists such as Thomas Henry Huxley, who was firmly convinced that species are so fixed that there can be no change from one into another. The idea of evolution appeared to lack scientific respectability, yet many wished to believe it. Now a book by a well-known scientist had appeared, presenting a method which its author felt was sufficient to explain the origin of every type of life from a previous type, and thus to make divine creation quite unnecessary. We have noticed two reasons for the great influence of Darwin's book. First, the fact that a man whose name stood for slow, methodical research rather than wild speculation was ready to endorse a theory that many had thought was held only by crackpots. And second, the widespread desire, often unrealized, for an escape from the ideas that had flowed from the Great Awakening of the previous century. Yet these by themselves would probably have failed to give it lasting significance. A third factor of at least equal importance resulted from the activities of T.H. Huxley. Huxley had known Darwin for about 5 years when the book appeared, and was very fond of him. During most of his adult life, Darwin suffered from a variety of illnesses. He had to spend a good deal of time in bed and rarely left his home, but still was able to devote a large part of his time to research and writing. When invited to attend a scientific meeting or to give a public address, he sometimes asked Huxley to go in his place. When Darwin told Huxley about his theory, Huxley declared that he did not believe that new species could develop by accident. He read Darwin's book before it was published and was not convinced. Yet after it appeared, he became its most active defender. He said that when he read it in book form, he'd come to see that it was true. There's much reason to believe that two psychological forces may have played a part in Huxley's change of attitude. One of these would be his great fondness for Darwin. He knew that there would be severe criticism by believers in divine creation, and he wished to protect his friend. 2 days before the scheduled date of publication, he wrote a letter to Darwin, which included the following paragraph. "I trust you will not allow yourself to be in any way disgusted or annoyed by the considerable abuse and misrepresentation which, unless I greatly mistake, is in store for you. Depend upon it, you have earned the lasting gratitude of all thoughtful men. And as to the curs which will bark and yelp, you must recollect that some of your friends, at any rate, are endowed with an equal amount of combativeness, though you have often unjustly rebuked them, which may stand you in good stead. I am sharpening my claws and beak in readiness." Soon after this, the Times invited Huxley to prepare a review of Darwin's book. The other psychological factor was Huxley's feeling about churches and church leaders. As a boy, he had been obliged to listen to long and dry sermons, which greatly repelled him, and he had developed a strong animosity to the church. An interesting illustration of Huxley's attitude toward the church is found in his description of an experience while engaged in the study of anatomy. At one time during his medical course, he found it very difficult to remember which side of the heart the mitral valve was on. Then, he said, it occurred to him that a bishop has a mitre. After that, he had no further difficulty. Since a bishop could not possibly be right, the mitral valve must naturally be on the left. At a later time, Huxley expressed his idea of theologians in these words. "Extinguished theologians lie about the cradle of every science as the strangled snakes beside that of Hercules. And history records that whenever science and orthodoxy have been fairly opposed, The latter has been forced to retire from the lists, bleeding and crushed, if not annihilated, scotched, if not slain. You get a little idea of Huxley's style from that. You can imagine what a debater he was for something he wanted to support. Huxley was 16 years younger than Darwin. He was a man of great intelligence, devoted to the study of science. He was also a man of strong emotions, much interested in religious philosophy and metaphysics. Darwin himself had a shy and retiring disposition and never liked to go to public meetings. He said that if he expressed a harsh word of criticism, he would be unable to sleep the following night. Public attacks upset him. Sometimes he wrote rejoinders, but usually he was glad to leave his defense to Huxley. In time, he came to speak of Huxley as my general agent. Huxley, however, referred to himself as Darwin's bulldog. Whenever Darwin's ideas were to be discussed at a great public meeting, Huxley was ready and fully armed. He was an able debater and a quick thinker on his feet, extremely skillful in handling repartee. Darwin and Huxley made an ideal combination. Huxley could speak vigorously and even caustically, while Darwin remained in the background as the quiet thinker, apparently standing aloof from the battle. The rapid spread and wide acceptance of Darwinism owed much to Huxley's vigorous support. In some ways, the Victorian era was quite unique. Although many of the scientific and literary figures had adopted positivist views and abandoned the biblical teachings of the Great Awakening, the effects of that far-reaching movement in establishing ideals of sincerity, truth, and decency were still almost universally honored, even if sometimes in a rather formal or stilted way. Thus, Mary Ann Evans, who wrote novels under the pen name of George Eliot, had completely abandoned the orthodox Christianity of her father, but nothing could shake her faith in a binding belief or spiritual law which is to lift us into willing obedience and save us from the slavery of unrequited passion or impulse. A visitor once reported with an admiration almost amounting to awe that he had heard her say, God, how inconceivable. Immortality, how unbelievable. Duty, how peremptory and absolute. Leslie Stephen said, I now believe in nothing, but I do not the less believe in morality. When Frederick Harrison, who has been described as the high priest of English positivism, was asked by his son what a man who falls in love but cannot marry is to do, he replied indignantly, Do what every gentleman does in such circumstances. Do what your religion teaches you. Do what morality prescribes as right. When his son persisted in wanting to know why love was proper only in marriage, Harrison could barely contain himself. A loose man is a foul man. He's antisocial. He's a beast. He finally put an end to the matter. It's not a subject that decent men do discuss. Thus, the evolutionists claimed to hold a standard of morality that would have rarely been found among the upper classes in the time of Darwin's grandfather. Occasionally, they were able to make the defenders of the Bible appear to be fighting for mere matters of wording, and thus seem to have forsaken the standard of sincerity and truth. One occasion of this sort has often been described. It was a large meeting at Oxford University, where representatives of both views were invited. All the principal supporters of evolution, except Darwin himself, were present. Huxley, who was as yet comparatively unknown, sat on the platform as Darwin's representative. The Bishop of Oxford, an able speaker with considerable knowledge of many fields of thought, presented a whole series of scientific arguments against Darwin's theory and then descended to ridicule. Turning to Huxley, he asked him whether it was through his grandfather or through his grandmother that he claimed descent from a monkey. Huxley startled the man who sat next to him on the platform by ejaculating, "The Lord hath delivered him into mine hands." When it was Huxley's turn to speak, he quietly presented a series of scientific arguments and went on to say that it was not Darwin's intention to prove a direct relationship between man and ape, but only the descent of both through thousands of generations from a common ancestor. Then he concluded with the words, "I asserted and I repeat that a man has no reason to be ashamed of having an ape for his grandfather. If there were an ancestor whom I should feel shame in recalling, It would rather be a man of restless and versatile intellect who, not content with an equivocal success in his own sphere of activity, plunges into scientific questions with which he had no real acquaintance, only to obscure them by an aimless rhetoric and distract the attention of his hearers from the real point at issue by eloquent digressions and skilled appeals to religious prejudice. And people were not accustomed to hearing a bishop described in such terms in those days, and especially an outstanding one as the Bishop of Oxford was. And it was great excitement. The woman fainted and had to be carried out, and it made quite a stir. But thus the adherents of evolution claimed to occupy higher ground and sought to use the results of the Great Awakening as a weapon against those who were defending the source from which those results had come. In later years, Huxley expressed doubts about the theory of natural selection, lamenting the lack of inductive evidence. From 1870 to 1872, he was a member of the London School Board. The Encyclopedia Britannica says, in the brief period during which he acted, probably more than any man, he left his mark on the foundations of national elementary education. He insisted on the teaching of the Bible, partly as a great religious heritage, partly because he was, quote, seriously perplexed to know by what practical measures the religious feeling, which is the essential basis of conduct, was to be kept up in the present utterly chaotic state of opinion in these matters without its use, end of quote. Huxley was invited to give the prestigious Romanus Lecture at Oxford in 1894, and he devoted part of it to urging that ideas of survival of the fittest be not carried over from the animal world to the area of human conduct, leading many evolutionists to think that the great champion had to some extent fallen by the wayside. Although the purpose of Darwin's book was to present natural selection as the method of evolution, a substantial part of the book was devoted to presenting the alleged evidence for evolution itself. Previous evolutionary writers, such as Lamarck and Darwin's own grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, were rather contemptuously dismissed, and the words "my theory" were frequently used. In later editions, "my theory" was changed to "the theory" in more than 40 places. In my opinion, one of the cleverest and most damaging things that Satan ever accomplished was the establishment of the word evolution as the common term for this theory. Actually, there are only two ways in which the great multitude of varying types of plants and animals could have come into existence. They were produced either by the intelligent choices of a wise creator or by an accidental effect of unintelligent forces. The word evolution can easily give an entirely false idea of what is meant, for it suggests that the important factor is merely change or development. It would have prevented a great deal of confusion if the theory had been designated by a more correct description, the theory of accidental origin. Once I heard a young man say, "How can you doubt evolution? Anyone can see the evolution of a boy into a man. It's perfectly obvious." This statement was not as absurd as it might seem. Change is a common fact of life. It would be difficult to imagine a greater metamorphosis than the case of a caterpillar that crawls on the ground and chews leaves, being changed into a butterfly or moth that hovers in the air and takes in liquid food sucked from flowers. Such a complete change in the life of a single organism would be hardly believable if it were not a frequently observed phenomenon. If these creatures were known to us only from fossils, no one would be apt to guess that a caterpillar that had died young and a beautiful butterfly, both preserved as fossils, were related at all. This illustrates the difficulty of making definite statements about the relationship of creatures known to us only through fossils. Anyone who looks about him is bound to see that change is constantly going on. If one returns to any part of the world after an absence of a few years, he's apt to find that great physical changes have occurred. He may be shocked to see the effects of upheavals or catastrophes. He's sure to find many results of slow and gradual change. In every phase of life, changes of one sort or another are constantly occurring. No child is exactly like either of its parents. The whole human race has descended from Adam,
Yet it today includes individuals who differ from one another in hundreds of ways. Human languages are constantly developing in various directions. When a man of today first looks at an English book written in the 13th century, he can hardly understand it. The Bible does not teach that things do not change. It's the scoffers rather than the Christians whom it describes as saying, all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation. 2 Peter 3:3-4. Christians should recognize the common fact of change. This, however, is very different from accepting as true the unfounded guess that all existing types of life have developed by natural processes from one simple beginning. The weakest feature of Darwin's theory was its unproved assumption that millions of varying types of viable plants and animals were constantly being produced, and that there was no limit to the extent to which these gradual variations might go. Observation and experiment do not bear out this assumption. While there may be confusion as to the proper definition of a species, it is easy to demonstrate that all plants and animals can be divided into a finite number of kinds, and that viable specimens beyond the limit of such kinds are rarely, if ever, found. In Darwin's day, it was easy to assume that research among fossils would produce such missing links, of which there would, of course, be great numbers. Despite the dogmatic assertions of Carl Sagan that the fossil chart proves evolution, one may reasonably wonder whether there is today any competent biologist who can still hold that there is definite evidence that such great numbers of intermediate forms ever actually existed. The present tendency among informed evolutionists is to say that new forms come into existence by sudden great jumps, such as, for instance, the birth of a bird from a serpent's egg. Aside from being a complete departure from Darwin's theory, such jumps, if they ever occurred, would come so seldom that the chances of ever being able to prove that one had occurred would be very slight. The problem of finding a cause for the alleged rise of the many varieties from which natural selection could eventually choose survivors was discussed by Darwin in some of his later books, in which he advanced such theories as pangenesis and sexual selection, none of which received any wide acceptance by other scientists. The dogmatic teaching of evolutionary theories as established fact has done great harm to Christian faith and has been a potent factor in the widespread lowering of moral standards. As far as Christian faith is concerned, one phase of its application has been particularly vital. I refer to its combination by Wellhausen with ideas of literary partition of the Bible that had previously been confined to the studies of a few scholars. Just as Darwinian evolution swept the scientific world during the years after 1859, this so-called higher criticism swept the theological world during the years after 1882 and eventually became dominant in most of the established theological seminaries. This aspect of evolutionary teaching, by causing great numbers of theological students to turn away from biblical dependability, has been effective in removing biblical faith from the teaching of numerous churches and even of whole denominations in many parts of the world. To the average layman, it appears rather incomprehensible, but its effect upon the churches has been widespread and deadly. Darwin was assuredly not one of the world's great thinkers, but the movement to which his name gave so great an impetus has had immeasurable effects. So much for Darwin, the man and the myth. I wonder if there'd be any questions anybody would like to ask. Did I cover everything? Yes.
Dr. Perry, I went through an article I saw a couple months ago about a guy that had access to Darwin's diary. And there was an indication in the diary that it's either diaries or letters to his son, in which he pretty much stated the idea that the theory of evolution, in a way, was way for him to justify the fact that his father was an unbeliever.
Well, yes. One of the arguments he gave against Christianity was that
so many people would be lost, people whom he admired and respected, one of whom was his father. But that was rather incidentally mentioned. Perhaps some of you have seen a tract that I saw a number of copies of a few years ago that told of an English woman who said that she visited Darwin 2 or 3 days before he died, and she mentioned how much people had lost their faith in Christianity through his book, and he said, oh, I would hate to think that such a thing could have happened. And the tract tried to show that Darwin had become a Christian, but there's absolutely nothing to that. He was a very, very gracious man. If it had been a Buddhist or a Mohammedan, he would have said the same thing, I'm sure. He hated to disagree with people. He let Huxley do that. His wife once wrote her daughter, and she says, Father is getting out a new book. She said, I know you'll enjoy reading it as I will, she said, but she said, I hate to think of it because it always makes God seem further away when another book by him comes out. And he wrote an autobiography in which he expressed his views very freely on a great many things. And after his death, his wife didn't want the unchristian statements in it published. And she had a big argument. She and the daughter wanted them expunged, and the sons wanted them kept, but the son who had charge of the publication agreed to refer to his mother's wish. And so they omitted quite a number of statements, which I believe it's been reprinted in full more recently, so that they are available. But there is no doubt that he was quite strongly anti-Christian in his general attitude. But he was not a fighter against Christianity. He wasn't a fighter on anything. In fact, he wanted to get along with everybody. He didn't like to express disagreement with people. Now, Marx saw the bearing of what he wrote much more fully than Darwin did. Karl Marx asked Darwin to let him dedicate the second edition of Marx's leading work, Das Kapital, to Darwin. And Darwin declined. But there's one place it says that he declined because to connect it with such an atheistic work would cause his wife and his children to feel unpleasant. But he was not a fighter, unless perhaps he was attacked. And when he was, he let the high school to defend him. Yes?
Your closing comment that he was not a great thinker, is that based primarily on this earlier writers who had given essentially the same view of the evolution?
Well, Huxley in later years said that he reread the book on the origin of species. It's a very difficult book, he said, very difficult. And in recent years, there have been some books by very good scholars who are very positive spoken about him. They say Huxley was a much better thinker than Darwin. And his writing is generally considered quite obscure. For instance, calling the theory of evolution my theory, when so many had done it before. And then another thing was that Lamarck, of course, Darwin said that Lamarck, in his theory of evolution that had come up, I guess about 50 years earlier, he said that Lamarck represented that there was a purpose in the constitution of various creatures, like when the tall animal reached up for the high tree, that it lengthened its neck when the giraffe did that, and so on. That there was a purpose of something in the constitution. Well, Darwin was very much against any idea of purpose, and he said that that his own grandfather's writings were very similar to the absurd ideas of Lamarck. But Professor Barzun of the Columbia University, who is dean of the faculty there, points out how in successive editions he modified those statements. And he says he started with cutting out all purpose, and then he gradually brought it in. And Barzun thinks it was quite
well, almost hypocritical to change so completely in his attitude toward that just by easy stages without admitting it. Arjuna is very critical of him as a thinker and as a writer, although, as he says, he actually was the precipitating instrument in a tremendous world change. But the myth is that he produced it, when actually he was more the front for it.
I read some years ago portions of his voyage to the HMS Beagle, which he made as the advantage observation.
Yes.
It seemed like, in all fairness, we could say he was a careful observer of what was going on around him.
Oh, yes. He was a very good observer, very careful in gathering material and studying it. And he probably would have, if it hadn't been for Wallace, he probably would have spent another 50 years, if he lived that long, adding a little more information and never gotten around to publishing the book. He was an observer rather than really a thinker. Yes?
Do you think that Huxley and Darwin believed that evolution was true? I mean, you indicate that there was at least some wobbling. What do you think in their heart of hearts? Do you think that they believed in evolution?
Oh, I think so, yes. Yes, as I said, there's only two possibilities. Either an intelligent creator planned and developed the tremendous complexity and wonderful arrangement of living matter. Either a great mind did, or it must have come into effect by accident. And the theory really, as I said, it really shouldn't be called the theory of evolution. It should be called the theory of accident. Because evolution just means development or change, and the world's full of that. But the whole point of evolution is that the change is produced by accident, not by an intelligent planet. And there are only the two, if you think about it. Of course, most people perhaps don't think about it. But if you think about it, there are only the two possibilities. And they were looking for a possibility other than believing in a creator. And if there is any, how could it come? And he thought of this clever idea that of the great mass of growing plants and animals, which differed a little from the parents, the ones that were strongest or fit the environment best, they would survive and the others wouldn't, and thus gradually it would improve. But of course there's no proof of that, and most important, there aren't that many variations.
I agree that there's only two alternatives.
Yeah.
But, you say that they were looking for an explanation other than an intelligent creator.
Yeah.
But then before that, you said they really did believe that this alternative explanation was true.
Well, how deep was the belief? Yeah. That's a psychological question.
What do you think? I mean, just pursuing your statement that they did believe that it was true, what do you think, I'm curious about your answer, what do you think were the reasons why they did believe that it had actually occurred?
Why they did believe it?
Yeah, why they did believe it.
Well, of course, Huxley had, until the book was actually published, he was very insistent that species never develop from one to another. That there's a sharp line between them. He was very convinced of that. That species never. That their species are completely distinct. Well, of course, according to Darwin's theory, there'd really be nothing, no such thing as species. That it would be only a temporary arrangement. But Linnaeus, who invented the whole idea of species, believed that each species was a direct creation of God, and that the species were separate and never would one develop out of another. So I think that is going too far. We don't know precisely what species is. It's pretty clear in general, but there are places where it's very difficult. But certainly there are kinds, and at least a good many kinds, of which there's absolutely no evidence of one developing into another. And of course, most people don't try to think about where things come from. They just go along day by day with whatever comes up.
But if you start to think, you've got to take one view or the other. It's either an intelligent creator or an accident. And if it's an intelligent creator, then you'd better learn something about him. But if it's accident, if it's just accident, well, what kind of accident could it be? And Darwin had an idea of what it might be. Now the general idea is that it came with a sudden jump from one type to something entirely different. And of course, that if you want to imagine that, well, you can believe anything. That is the theory held by most biologists today, I believe. Despite Sagan speaking so dogmatically about the theory of natural selection being completely proved, I doubt if there is a competent biologist today who thinks that there is such a thing as gradual change with great numbers in between. Yes?
That's great.
Yeah.
This past weekend I was down in Washington, this past I looked at the exhibit on evolution.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting.
Yeah.
And it seems like it's extremely well accepted, I guess, by many, many people.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, it's so difficult to handle to hold on to. Why do so many people hold on to it?
Because they're taught in school. They're taught it in school, and it's stated as fact in newspapers and magazines and so on. And most people simply take what they're told. Yes?
Evolution today, I mean, 20 years ago, it was still a theory, but considered to be a theory. And a lot of times, you'll hear people say that it's only a theory. And to a certain extent, from the evolutionary point of view, that's really wishful thinking on the part of the church. It is evolution in its philosophy is gone beyond that now. It's not, it went from theory to fact. The literature would support that. But now it has gone from fact to inevitable. I think that's a theme that really comes through in the context of the fact that that it is inevitable. And if it isn't happening here, it doesn't matter. It'll happen in one of the other shows. The probability is
But that's pure theory, pure imagination.
But I've seen, over the 20 years, I've seen a change where at one time it might have been Popper's theory, then it became fact. And the only question is what the mechanism was. Now it seems to have gone one step beyond to the level of inevitable.
I think it was 15 years ago at least, nearer 20, that Mr. Dunstwaller lent me a book on evolution by a professor in Stanford University. And in the front of it, he said, the fact of evolution is just as definite as the fact of the existence of a mountain that you can look at. But he said, as to how evolution came, he said, there are many theories. Well, what is a fact that you can see like you can see a mountain about evolution? It's a matter, it is a fact that if there's no intelligent creator, it must be so. There's no proof, it's purely imaginary. But if you won't believe in God, and if you insist on having some explanation for the universe, why accident's the only other possibility. Dr. Newman?
Yeah, some of the people speak this way. I think from talking to a few of them, have in mind the idea that the Christian position is zap, 6,000 years ago, all of these things came into existence and there was never any change.
Yeah.
But we see in the geologic record there's change, therefore we're right and they're wrong.
Yeah.
And they don't take seriously the possibility that the Christians who seriously believe the Bible hold an older earth, and that there was a time when God created the simple stuff and filled the earth with it, and then on top of that, and then on top of that, etc. So they're not really responding to that kind of theory.
Yeah.
They respond to the other. So they talk like, I mean, there's the mountain, and then you look at the straight in the mountain, and there's the simple stuff down there, and the complicated stuff up here.
Sure.
I think that's probably what those guys have got in mind. I was on a talk show with a guy, Forrest, one thing, some years ago, and he tried to say, evolution is change.
Yep.
Just as you suggested here.
Yep.
But he did not mean by that he wasn't saying anything. He meant that just a change occurs and all these things, evolution occurs.
Yep.
What do you got obscurantist arguing with people?
Sure. Just as a child develops or evolves into a man. And that, of course, is, I think is one of Satan's masterpieces, was getting this word evolution established. Because evolution just means change or development, and we all believe in change or development. The Bible nowhere suggests there isn't a great deal of change or development. But the question is, how is such change or development guided? And what proof is there that everything came from one simple start, that's purely an adoption of an assumption? And someone like Sagan can make the wildest assumptions and state them as facts. Yes?
Christian, very useful to combat that problem with word evolution by saying, I believe in microevolution, but I don't believe in macroevolution. Microevolution can be spraying for DDT, and we find resistant mosquitoes developing, and more and more resistant develops. That's microevolution. That really happened to the population.
Yeah.
Macroevolution is this idea that everything came from the common amoeba or whatever, something way back there, and came up from that. The fossil record has become increasingly embarrassing to macroevolution. We need to fight, I think, with that against
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Focus a little bit on Darwin's wife and the relationship and get your insight from your reading. If I recall, he was an Episcopalian. That's incorrect, correct me.
Well,
I think it is, and what I wanted to know is, if that was true, how conservative would an Episcopalian in 1860s, 1870s be compared, I don't want to label them, but they're not very conservative today. this is the nicest way I can say it.
Well,
how would that have been different in the 1870s?
They were, many of them were very, very conservative even 60 or 70 years ago.
What kind of relationship, the strain in the relationship between his quote, evolving idea and her conservative faith? What are some of the insights you have on that, the relationship?
Well, he was very anxious not to displease her, and he purposely kept from expressing his religious ideas. Actually, he started in saying that he believed everything. He believed the Bible. His father suggested he become a minister, and he had no doubt the Bible was true, but he wasn't sure about the deity of Christ, so he better go a little slow about deciding. And when he was on the Beagle, he insisted that all the species were distinct. And some people had gotten that idea, that's a basic thing of Christian teaching, that all species are distinct. But that comes from Linnaeus, not from the Bible. It said that they should reproduce after their kind, but that a kind is what Linnaeus called a species. My guess would be it is in the overwhelming majority of instances, but not necessarily. It could be, as far as the Bible's concerned, it could be a genus. We don't know how far development comes. And I think, as I said, that Satan, one of his greatest successes was leading people to think that the idea of change or development was some way unchristian. It isn't at all. But it's the idea of lack of purpose, that it's just accident. That's what's unchristian. And if there's any purpose, there must be a purpose. So there must be a God who ordained it, and if there is such a being, it would be natural for him to try to communicate with the creatures he's made. And so the question is the Bible God's word or not? And there's just the two differences, basically. But, of course, during the years since, evolution has been taught as an established fact. I read a book 40 years ago or more by an English a teacher in an English school who told how when students would come to begin taking rather advanced work, and he said he would examine them to see what their intelligence was and so on, and he would say, what would you give as the leading arguments against evolution? And he says, practically everyone would say, well, I didn't know there were any. I thought everybody believed it. And he said though he himself believed in it, he thought that a great many of the alleged evidences for it were very weak, and he would try to get them to thinking things through a bit more. But it became a sort of a standard that if a person was intelligent, he was supposed to believe in it. And that was gradually extended through the schools in England and in this country. Yes?
The tracking method. I saw the most recent one, and I believe it was written, or rewritten by Oswald Smith. That's the name that I was talking about in the background. Although he was not the original writer. That raises a problem of misuse of science, the misuse of fact by those who were training for the ministry and those who were in the ministry. That certainly says something about the role of the seminary to make sure that their students learn. In other words, they have to learn to be capable to use, if they're going to speak about science, they have to do the homework. And it really, was disturbing to me to see Oswald Smith's name on that track. And yet, one of the main articles against that track was printed by the Creation Research Society, Wilbur Rust, did a really good job on that, and he thoroughly disputed it. But it does raise that question again, in the ministry. If you're not qualified to deal with an issue,
The student who goes into an unbelieving institution and immediately is going to convert the professors and prove they're wrong is the very one who is apt to come out having completely capitulated and be a strong arguer for what was given. I knew a young fellow who, he told me that he was not, he said his life didn't amount to anything until he was about 18, and then he was converted. And he became a very earnest Christian. He went to the Bible Institute for 3 years and came out and, a wonderful, wonderful evangelist in many ways he seemed to be. And I saw him in college. This is many years ago. And I would go on a geology trip, and this fellow would argue with the professor. He was going to convince him. And it was interesting to see how the professor just lead him, you know. What this? And he would get him to a point that was absolutely, you could show was absurd. He would lead him on, and he'd get him to that point. And after a few experiences like that, he was sort of put on his face, you might say. And when he graduated, and I was coming to Princeton Seminary, which was then Orthodox, he told me how foolish I was to do that. He says, I've read their catalog. They think they know everything. They just say, here's the truth, come and get it. He said, I don't want to go to school like that. I know what I want. I want a good church in Southern California, he says. And he says, when you go off chasing after moonbeams, and you come back from Alaska where it's frozen and cold, I'll let you preach for 3 months in my church. It just completely flipped over. And the influence, I sometimes wonder how the Lord brought me through what I got, but I think one reason is I always had a naturally skeptical frame of mind about everything I heard everywhere. And so I got used to thinking things through rather than trying to prove the professor who knew 10 times what I did about this subject that he was wrong. Somebody else or other. I guess we've covered the whole subject. There's some other angles I was hoping somebody would say something about.
So they want to thank you very much, Dr. McCray.